So, hello everybody. I'm very pleased that we have such a full room. Yes, welcome to this panel. It's called Visual Memories, Queer Photographic Observers of the 20th Century. And I'm really excited because I think photographies are such an important material, but it's also such a difficult material to work with. And today we're going to hear about it from different perspectives, artistic perspectives, historical perspectives, activist perspectives. So we're going to have a good time. My name is Maria Bühner. I'm a historian working on the history or her story of lesbians in East Germany. So how is this going to go? I mean, probably we all used to it, but everybody is going to... We have four awesome presenters. Each one of them has approximately 15 minutes to give their presentation, and in the end we're going to have a combined discussion. We have a change in the running order, so no panic, everybody is there and is going to present, just in a different order. So Karl-Heinz Steindler is going to start, then we have Sari Zamini's presentation on Frank Scholten's photographies in Palestine. Then Ruth Sandler-Cathy is going to talk about collections from Johannesburg. And Judith Babo is going to conclude the presentations with her own photographic work, which is documenting LGBT activism in Hungary. Yes, and I'm going to give you a few announcements. After these sessions, we should all go out to the stairs overlooking the pond, because there will be like this photography, this group photo, and I mean, we are all know it's important to document our history, so we should go there for a nice picture. Yes, and then there will be this closing event in the evening. You're all warmly invited from the organizers to go there. But we're going to start, I'm going to start now with introducing our first speaker. Karl-Heinz Steindl studied history and Slavic studies. He worked as a researcher and curator at Schwules Museum Berlin and was its managing director from 2009 to 2013. In 2013, Steindl started his own business as a historian and consultant for films, projects and collections. Its main research focus is lives, places, and open spaces in the 20th and 21st centuries. And today he's going to talk about A Day in the Life of Eberhard Borg, a Berlin gay life in the 20th century. And some of you may already know Eberhard Borg because last night at the documentary film night, there was a small documentary on these collections. So.
So hello, I'm starting with some words about the life of Mr. Brooks, and then I will show you some photographs. Eberhard Brooks was born in Berlin in 1917. His parents owned a gardening shop, but lost their whole assets during the Depression era. In 1933, the family moved to a small flat in Berlin-Lankwitz, a borough situated south of the city center. After the father's death in 1946, Brooks remained living there in this little flat with his mother, who deceased in 1978. He stayed in the flat more than 75 years, and he died in 2008. Eberhard Brooks worked as a painter, as a graphic designer, photographer, as an extra for films and theater. Brooks was self-taught and producing incessantly. He worked on illustrations and drawings, explored Berlin life with his camera, portrayed others as well as himself very often, and wrote and received countless letters, more than 5,000. Throughout his life, he collected and archived all kinds of testimonies, be they personally or produced by others. He bequeathed this enormous stock to the Gay Museum. the Brooks collection there covers more than 77 decades and is exemplary for German and Berlin history as well as their clear aspects. Eberhard Brooks lived a life of a bohemian and was a survival artist. He pursued seemingly contradictory interests and drifted along. Nevertheless, he recorded everything, be it text or image. In this reflection of the self and others, he doesn't contrast strongly from other people, leading a non-heteronormative life and being excessively concerned with their self-images. The fact that he virtually kept everything allows us to a complex insight into gay life in Berlin in the 20th century. When the Brooks collection was handed over in 2004, it was in a complete desolate and disorderly state. Possibly Brooks intended this in order to obscure evident gay traces. Had there been a house search or a raid in the flat, which was a common procedure from 1933 up till the late 60s in case of the suspicion of homosexual acts, the pictures and documents in his collection would have led to investigations against him and against a lot of other people. Protection by abundance was one of the scarce comments Brooks himself uttered on this issue. Already during the training as a costume designer, which was interrupted due to the war, Brooks photographed a lot. Serving the Reich Labor Service and as a soldier of the Wehrmacht, he always had his compact camera with him. He had his film processed by a chemist who was a friend, which allowed him to entrust him with pictures of lovers or nude photos. In 1954, Brooks started to process his films himself and to make his own photo prints. In order to that, he installed a dark room in the tiny, tiny bathroom of his Lankwitz flat. The small hallway was converted into a studio for his photo sessions. Now, Brooks was no longer forced to hand over his pictures to other persons. This broadened his possibilities enormously. He was much more independent in his choice of subject, had much more freedom concerning experiments, and was able to photograph intimate, erotic, and even pornographic settings. Apart from that, he intensively occupied himself with portrait photography, which was to become a new source of income. Nevertheless, the risk of being punished according to paragraph 175 and the law against the production, possession, and distribution of obscene writings and pictures still persisted. Even more so, as Brooks had few customers whose pornographic amateur pictures he processed and printed on account. In the Gay Museum, Eberhard Brooks' material was step by step arranged and cataloged. First results were shown in an exhibition on occasion of his 19th birthday in 2008. This exhibition was accompanied by this catalog you would see here and you can have a look at. Amongst the collection, there were many photographic films which have been preserved as complete film strips. They served Brooks as a stock for photo prints for his male and female customers' orders, and for his experiences. Some of the films, packings, or single individual prints were labeled by Brooks himself. These specifications allow to a temporal and thematic assignment, thus specific periods of his life can be reconstructed. Months, weeks, and even single days. For my presentation, I chose a preserved film from October 1960. At that time, Brooks was almost 43 years old and lived, by his standards, a rather stable life. He had a happy relationship with Hans-Joachim Pelke, called Hansi, who was 5 years younger than him. Hansi was accepted by Brooke's mother, Martha, and shared his interest for photography. Apart from minor orders, Brooks worked regularly for the Künstler Not Program, the artist's emergency program of the Senat of West Berlin. His basic income was derived from the occupation as an extra at the Volksbühne in Eastern Berlin. As a West Berliner working in East Berlin, Brooks was one of the 50,000 so-called border crossers. In the political separated, but until the building of the wall in August 1961, completely accessible Berlin. With his employee ID card of the Volksbühne, Brooks bought photo equipment, which was affordable, much more affordable in East Berlin, and had to smuggle it to West Berlin, as this was forbidden and strictly controlled. Now we'll see the film strip from October 1960, with 39 photographs. They were taken between Sunday 15th of October and Monday 18th of October. On Saturday 15th of October, Eberhard Brooks photographs Meta Dato, the mother-in-law of his sister Ruth. On the same day, photos were taken of Erik Türk, you see him here, an extra colleague, and of Eberhard Brooks himself in front of the Berlin Volksbühne. They are wearing the costumes of the play 10 Days That Shook the World by Heiner Müller, based on John Reed's book about the Russian Revolution 1917. This is Brooks. Like every Sunday, Eberhard and Hansi spent the 16th of October the next day together. Obviously, the weather is bad, as they usually go on excursions. They photograph each other in the hallway of the Langblitz flat, which leads to a photo series Eberhard Brooks is also making prints of. On Monday, 17th of October, Brooks visits the dentist Willy Galler in the neighboring borough Lichterfelde. One can deduce from old letters that they should have had a love affair around 1947. Meanwhile, Galler is married and has children. Back at home, Brooks takes some photos of his bachi Schätzeli at the kitchen window of the flat. The bird flies out of the cage and then can be seen inside it again. And that's it. Thank you very much.
Second presenter today is Sari Zaniri. Sari Zaniri is an Australian-Palestinian artist and cultural historian. His current research considers the imaging of masculinity in the Middle East and ways in which transnational Christian Orthodox relations between the Arab world, Russia, and Greek form an interstitial space between categories of East and West. He was a coordinator of the Palestinian Film Festival Australia from 2014 till 2016 and associate lecturer at the Monash Fine Art Department from 2014 till 2018. He is currently a postdoctoral fellow of the NWO-funded project Crossroads, European Cultural Diplomacy and Arab Christians and Palestine 1918-1948 at Leiden University. You can also see a small exhibition of Frank Scholten's photographies, which Zari is going to present on today in the foyer, just like underneath the bookstore at the level where we are on. You can see more photographies. And the title of today's presentation is Homosexuality, Biblical Narrative and the Classical, Frank Scholten's Photographing Palestine.
Sorry, folks, technical difficulties.
Can we please open the door? If it's not, maybe it helps a little bit with the, you know.
It takes up a noise from the other lecture.
Okay.
Maybe we can open the door behind.
The what? They are already open, as you can.
Can we wait it now? Well, it doesn't matter
yeah.
for the moment.
Yeah. Maybe if you could just leave the door open a little bit.
So.
I just don't have my notes, but I mean, West Coast or West, I think.
Does someone have an idea how to
if
open
it? You have a second laptop, you can open it on the other laptop and look at your notes.
I didn't bring it. Oh, that's right, I'll remember most of it.
Okay.
No worries.
Thank you for improvising. So,
thanks.
The stage is yours.
So Frank Scholten was a Dutch photographer who was born in 1881. He came from quite a wealthy background. His mother was actually part of the Dutch nobility and who'd married a businessman. And he was also queer. He'd had sort of various adventures through in the lead up to World War I. Eventually in 1920 decides to go to Palestine. So he spends a year travelling through Italy and Greece before he arrives in the Levant. And he goes with this idea of doing an illustrated Bible. So he, you know, it's a very sort of lofty aim of producing an image for every single verse of the Bible, which was supposed to happen over 12 volumes. I'm not going to harp on too much about the biography because there's quite a lot of material to go through, but we'll move into sort of looking at some of the images. I think one of the things about Scholten is... we really have to think about him through multiple lenses and the way these sort of lenses interact. You know, the history of photography is very much entwined with colonialism in Palestine. The very first photograph of Jerusalem is actually taken in 1839, the same year that photography is invented as a technological process. But on the one hand, we need to think about it within these sort of contexts of Orientalism, within these sort of rubrics of this sort of notional otherness. But also within the sort of sexual rubrics of the time. Homosexuality had been decriminalised across the Ottoman Empire in 1858, so quite early on. You know, there are a lot of Orientalist narratives about a sort of a lascivious Middle East. And when we look at a lot of the European Orientalists who are travelling through the Middle East at this point in time, quite a number of them are actually queer. So there's a sort of a sense of, like, a space in which, you know, the East is seen as a sort of a sexually permissive space, which is quite different to the way we think about it these days. The second lens that we need to really think about in terms of Scholten's work is this idea of biblification, which is a term that was coined by Issam Nasr, a Palestinian-American academic. And biblification is a mode of approaching Palestine through a Christian lens. And if we look at pretty much all 19th century photography of Palestine, almost universally, it's vested in biblical narrative. It's about holy sites, it's much more about the landscape. Often these landscapes are quite empty. Where we do get people within them, they're sitting within a few different categories, either biblical occupations like carpenters in Jerusalem or fishermen in the Galilee, or within these sort of rubrics of ethnography, so Jews at the Wailing Wall, or an authentic Saracen or, you know, an Eastern Christian. So this sort of lens of Christianity is really sort of formative in the way Palestine was imaged and created a certain biblical imaginary, and one that didn't really include any of the sort of, you know, Palestinian modernity or Eastern Mediterranean modernity. So there's sort of an erasure, an indigenous erasure going on there. The third rubric through which we need to think about Scholten's work is this idea of classicism and these sort of classical bodies, you know. He's looking, when we look at a lot of the archive, there's sort of two main sort of areas. One is this body of photographs that he takes, and although it's uncatalogued, conservative estimates are that there's at least 20,000 photographs taken over a 3-year period, but it could potentially be up to 27,000. And the other sort of major section of the archive are clippings and photographs and things taken from books and magazines, which is sort of a way for him to work through and process all of these images that he'd taken. I would also like to say the images that I'm showing you today are just a very small snippet, you know, so it's a very, tiny fragment of the broader collection, but they are the ones that sort of best display some of the queer narratives. You know, he also takes a lot of photos of archaeological sites, of people, and of people across a whole series of confessional and class divides. And I think, you know, one of the things about Scholten, he's born a Protestant. We don't know when he converted, but he did convert to Catholicism. So coming from a Dutch perspective and, you know, from a Dutch context, you know, in which we've got a process of pillarisation, I think one of the strengths of the collection is that he actually, not only does he have a documentary approach, which is quite different to these more sort of staged kind of images, but they're also, it's also a collection that kind of, that has a sensitivity to the diversity of people who were living in Palestine at the time. Now, the sort of dynamic between the clippings and the photographs is quite interesting, and one of the figures that turns up quite often through a lot of these clippings that he takes is the figure of David. And David is a really interesting figure in that he links to a whole series, you know, there's actually quite a number of queers who are arriving in Palestine in the, you know, the sort of interwar period who are also obsessed with the idea of David. People like Charles Ashby would be a very good example. But the other thing about this sort of milieu is that it kind of starts to reference these queer subtexts. We've got this sort of, here we've got an image by, a clipping by George Haywood Sumner, who is very much a part of the arts and crafts movement. So David's body starts to kind of stand in for a means of thinking about other bodies that exist within this space. And, you know, people like Charles Ashby were very much responsible for shaping the way Jerusalem now exists today. But also kind of this sort of... sorry, I wish I had my notes. This sort of obsession with the way we could kind of think about sort of biblical bodies and people's bodies, and this sort of conflation of the two becomes an alibi for perhaps something that's more invested in a sort of an interest in those bodies. So the Christian narrative starts to become a means of explaining away certain queerer interests. As some of you may or may not know, David had a very close friendship with Jonathan, and you know, particularly within the context of the Book of Samuel. And so when we actually look at some of these images of Jonathan and David together and start to look at some of the sort of pairings of people that occur in these photographs, we can start to think a little bit more about some of these, you know, these sorts of relationships. And, you know, here we have quite a handful of relationships. The one that's in the top left for you is actually taken in Tel Aviv. So these would be... To Jewish members of the Third Aliyah, so sort of Eastern European Jews who had migrated to Palestine. He spent quite a lot of time in various kind of early Jewish settlements. Some of the photographs are quite intimate, you know, guys sort of lying in their beds. So, you know, he's clearly sort of developing close relations with different communities. On the right-hand side, we have a photo that is labelled the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem with a sheikh from Tripoli. I'm not actually sure that this... I think this photograph might be mislabeled, but, you know, nonetheless, I think this sort of interesting pairing kind of starts to speak to some of these modes of homosociality. And going back to this idea of Orientalism and these sort of perceptions of masculinity within the Middle East, you know, we do have quite a lot of gender segregation, which is sometimes enforced and sometimes not enforced, but creates certain spheres in which men are actually communicating with one another and spending time with one another. But one of the things that's quite interesting about the collection is that when we start to piece together some pieces of Skolten's biography, we can start to kind of read these images in slightly different ways. Here's a series of images. The one that's on the far left is actually a clipping from David's Mighty Men. For those of you like myself who are not particularly biblically informed, these were David's elite force. And during his war with Saul, they broke through enemy lines to bring back water for David, who throws the water away, you know, which starts to become an allegory for love of God over love of fellow man. But going back to biography, we also know from some of the writings about Jacob Israel de Haan, who was a Jewish Dutch writer who wrote the first novel published in Dutch that was openly gay, which was published in 1909, that Skolten also spent a fair bit of time hanging out at train stations, particularly Amsterdam Centraal, picking up military men. So we have quite a few photos of military men which pop up consistently through the collection, and the one on the far right is taken at Amsterdam Centraal, but the others are all taken in Palestine. But when we start to kind of look at these images en masse and compare them to other images within the collection, we actually start to see this whole series of homosocial spaces, which can actually start to kind of give us hints at what sort of places he might be hanging out. And these ranged from sort of church institutions to the scouts, as we've got in the bottom right, through to Islamic schools, through to a whole series of spaces. So in trying to sort of get a sense of what was happening sexually within Palestine at the time, it's quite a useful collection to try and infer how these sorts of movements were happening. Also, within the context of Jacob Israel de Haan, who leaves Amsterdam for Palestine with these very Zionist agendas, when he arrives, he actually becomes increasingly critical of Zionism and starts to find it quite repugnant, particularly after he meets a Palestinian boyfriend and settles down with him. Incidentally, Jacob Israel de Haan would also be the first political assassination by the Zionist movement in 1924. Given that I'm running out of time, I'm going to talk a little bit quicker. But we've got an image here on the right by Arnold Zadikov, who some of you may or may not have come across. It's another statue of David. Zadikov was Jewish and actually went on to later on design Magnus Hirschfeld's tomb. So we can actually start to see that there's a whole queer network within Europe, but also within Palestine, both within Arab and Jewish communities, that starts to kind of undermine some of the sort of perceptions that we might have of contemporary conflict. But this particular statue of David was actually out the front of the Berlin Museum. And, you know, it's very much a part of this narrative of the remaking of the Jewish body in response to sort of European anti-Semitism. And I think it's a very interesting comparison to some of the photos that Skolten takes of these more Zionist spaces, which range from, you know, these sort of new Jewish bodies on the beach, these strong Jewish bodies, to sports clubs, to this idea of Zionist labour. And these sorts of tropes turn up quite a lot within Skolten's work. This slide here has a section that's taken from James Neill's Palestine and the Bible. And I think that, you know, one of the things that I'm finding particularly interesting through the course of this conference, and I'm not really a scholar of or a historian of sexuality. My research is predominantly about Palestine. But it sort of starts to open up possibilities for thinking about indigenous sexualities within Palestine. And I think, you know, the sort of combination of homosociality and these sort of photographs gets us starting to rethink some of these sorts of questions. And for those of you who probably don't know that much about Palestinian politics and Palestinian social structures and their sort of shifting over time, you know, modernity affects these communities quite dramatically in that... you know, historically, your major divisions would be, in terms of the Eastern Mediterranean, would really be between urban populations and rural populations. But, you know, it's sort of, I mean, you know, there's different ways of conceiving of modernity, but within the way modernity develops in the Levant, you know, urban populations really kind of, they get the better end of the deal, you know. They sort of become this sort of middle class, as we might conceive it within a Western kind of concept of structure. And, you know, these sort of rural kind of groupings. And I think, you know, an image like this, which is taken from a sort of a biblical tract, essentially gives us a way of sort of thinking about these sort of Bedouins who are actually from Jordan versus more middle class kind of queer images. I haven't quite tracked it down yet, but I think this might be Dahan's Palestinian boyfriend, Awaida. But I think we also start to get a bit of a sense of how class structure might interact with sexuality in the Middle East. The other thing that I would say about it, and one of the things, you know, reflecting on the last couple of days of, you know, this wonderful conference and all of the wonderful contributions that people have made, one of the things that I've really been thinking about is actually a language for describing some of these sort of modes of sexuality and how we can kind of conceive of them. And I think in some ways trying to sort of look at these photos through a Western lens is a highly problematic thing. You know, I think it's very easy for us today to think of terms like homosexual or gay or lesbian or queer as universal identities. But actually within this sort of context of Eastern Mediterranean culture, I think that we need to sort of really conceive of new ways of kind of talking about this and the sort of the pluralities of how sexual identity might function. Anyway, on that note, I might leave it there. So thank you.
While you're starting your presentation, okay?
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So now we're gonna hear a presentation from Ruth Branson Corsi. Ruth Branson Corsi is founder and co-founder of the Oxford Queer Studies Network, a founding member of Queer Research UK, and a DPhil researcher in the English faculty at the University of Oxford. The Integral Stuart Hall Doctoral Studentship, in association with Morton College, Torch, and the Student Hall Foundation, supports Ruth's DPhil research on the QP connection of photographs. Ruth serves on the panel of the judges for Miss Gay Western Cape 2018. You're going to tell us about this? No.
No.
Maybe later. So our fourth presenter today is Judith Sabour, and she's going to present her own work. I'm really excited about the insights we are getting today of LGBT movements in Hungary. Judith Sabour is a retired economist, worked as a scientific researcher, economist, editor-in-chief, and university assistant professor. She was a founding member and is a former board member of Background Society, according to its original name, Background Society for Homosexuals. Nowadays, she is a member of the society's advisory board and works in its archive. In the 1990s, five of her partially gay-themed short stories were published in a literary periodical, and several of her radio commentaries were aired in Hungarian radio. The title of today's presentation is Photo Series Representing the Private Life and Civil Activity of the LGBTQ People in Hungary.
Thank you, Maria.
So I have bought one series. It's long enough. It's about gay pride movements in Hungary, the march, and we for a long time have gay pride week and now gay pride month, and in the last times we call it Budapest Pride. My presentation is based on pictures, and I don't want to speak a lot. I try to leave time you to see the pictures in this. As a photographer, I believe the strength of one single picture. So there are three photographers of this series, Gábor Takács Bence, János Breznik, and me. Mostly these are my photos. And the selection is mine, so I went through, I think, 2,000 photos, with the exception of mine. Gábor Takács Bence's photos were digitalized from paper. János Breznik photos, all of them are digital photos. My photos were scanned from film and in the new era digital one. So let's start. I made periods from since 1992 until now. The first Pride March was in 1997, but some pink picnics were before this event. The first was in 1992. It was absolutely secret. A certain circle knew about it. It was very romantic. The second also was that type. And the third, from which I didn't bring a photo, was open and advertised in a popular excursion place of Budapest. This is the second picnic, and in my series I will denominate the great figures of Hungarian LGBT movement, but now I have no time to go into details about their life. Lajos Romzaver was the first person who came out in Hungary in the mass media. He was a psychiatrist, physician, and we miss him very much. Already died. This is Gábor Takács Bence's photo about the first Pride March. You can see our beloved capital, Budapest, the panorama on it, and the marching people. We thought we will be few, but we were not few, at about, I don't know, 150 people or something like this. We were in a hurry to a popular square of Budapest. In this square, Balázs Pálffy gave a speech. These radio comments of mine were broadcasted in his program in the Hungarian radio. This is the final point of the first March. I try to emphasize only one banner. This is it's a pleasant thing to be a faggot. Húzinak lenni jó. This is the first emblem of the Háttér Society, Background Society. It started as a hotline, but now there's many much things. The the age of consent for homosexual acts was 14 years until the heterosexual was 14 years and homosexual 18, and the equal age of consent was made into act in 2002, age of 14. The first Pride marches were very family-like type, a small track leads the march, and we were walking freely on the main shopping street of Hungary, and people walk by just walking further, so there were no problem. And such type of attacks were also family made, and one person with a banner that you have to go home. The March of 1999 got much critics from gay and lesbian people because of this family-made type, and there were no loud music in the march, so later the march became professionally, and this era began in 2000. Almost every LGBT week or month had a slogan, and it is important what is the slogan. So the truck is bigger, but there are horses also. Police is in white shirts, short sleeves. They must be foreigners. I was looking for them for a long time, asked every Hungarian acquaintance who they are. If you know who they are, please tell me. I used watermark only once in my life, but now I couldn't digitally remove it, and I had no time to remove it by Photoshop, remove them. But not only the watermarked pictures are mine. Okay. You have seen this banner at the occasion of first Pink Picnic. This is a quotation, and I couldn't translate relevantly because it really means that my sweet homeland let me be. again our beloved Budapest. And a new era begins. The 2007 and 2008 photos were shot by János Breznik. I carried a banner in 2007 and I was ill in 2008. 2007 was the first year when a serious Nazi attack was against the Gay Pride March. They throw the eggs to us, they throw the beer bottles, stones, made smoke, big dust. It was terrible, and at the end of the march they shouted that we have to throw faggots to the Danube and the Jews after them. The whole socialist free democrat government, almost the whole, was sitting in the first row in 2007. And the people are celebrating Gábor Szetei's coming out. Here is Judith Takács, whom I am the shadow in this conference, because I meet people and say, yeah, Judith, I know one other Judith from Hungary, Judith Takács. There are Hungarian and foreign celebrities on the banners. I carry one of these banners. Károly Kerbeni was the journalist, translator, writer who devised the denomination homosexuality, and he has now a tomb in the National Cemetery. And every year we celebrate, remember him at his tomb. And I have time to show you the other dark day in 2008. This was the first year when the march went among fences. Actually, I mean double fences. There were fences like this, and in the side streets also were fences. Nobody could go to the march. There were one checkpoint at the beginning and one at the end. They were throw with eggs already. And this year was a serious Nazi attack. Was against the march from behind the fence. This is the same year. And the police prepared a big cage surrounded with fences. Yes, okay, I'll conclude. And people had to be there, I think, more than 2 hours. and the Nazis were outside and shake the fences. Not in this picture, but later. And marching people escaped to the city park, but there were fences also behind them. Thank you for your attention. I have one slide to show you. Yeah. Now is the LGBT month in Hungary, and the Pride March will be next Saturday. So if you can, come to the Budapest Pride March.
Together. I mean, it was really crossing generations, crossing time and space. Now at the panel open for your questions. I'm sure you have many. Oh yes, and it's questions, not comments. And also I want to encourage all these people who are usually not speaking up or whose voices are often made silent to see this as a space where they can come forward.
Yeah.
So, question?
For sort of everyone, really. Plans to publish these papers and whatnot. Like they're developing. Is there anywhere that we can sort of access more of your writing to look at it further from your perspectives or something like that?
I have another project entitled Androgynous People, and I published it already in a group exhibition of the the free school. Then I graduated as photographer at the BA level, and I worked it, on it further on, and I have the intention to have an exhibition of androgynous people. This is a black and white series. And to tell the truth, I with the Pride Festival series, my intention mainly to archive it, I would like to make good quality selection, collection of it, the others and mine. Photos, and later we shall see. We had a three-member group exhibition until I think from about the photos 2000 since 2000 four or 5 years of the Pride March. I was one of the photographers. Cathy Holland was the other, whose exhibition about London Jewish LGBT communities on the wall outside, and Theo Erdély was the third, and we carried around Hungary this exhibition of at about 40 pictures.
So I'm doing my PhD. Hopefully it'll be done in January 2021. I have it, sorry. But So this is kind of a few bits mashed together from an article that is under consideration at the moment with a journal. So fingers crossed.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe soon, I hope.
Keep an eye.
I mean, I would love to have published writing. It's just, yeah, I need to get someone to publish it. But if you are at all interested in mine, we can swap emails and I'll let you know when I do. Thank you.
Well, I'm the co-author of this catalog.
Yes.
I showed you, but and this was published 11 years ago, and now I'm freelancer, and now I have the chance to have a new look on this really great collection.
Yeah.
And have and find out new perspectives. And yesterday I had been the pleasure to be a chair of another section session. And in this session there was Ineta Lipscher, who is here today, and she presented the story of a gay man in Latvia who is also 90 years old and who lived 90 years, nearly the whole century, the 20th century. And I think this would maybe a good project to combine this or to think about these two characters and two of these biographies. And this, I take these questions as a chance now as a freelancer to go back to this collection.
I've got one article published on Spalten at the moment, sadly in Dutch, not in English, so maybe not that accessible to most people. But there's two more in the pipeline in a book chapter. In terms of queer narratives, I've mostly been looking at his more ethnographic work. But yeah, I'm hoping to, I mean, this is the beginning stages kind of, in terms of looking at the queer narratives there. So I'm kind of hoping to develop it into a paper. But no publication plans at the moment.
Hi, I'm realizing the native English speakers are quicker to ask, so there's a pregnant pause. So I'll keep this brief. I was really interested in how all the papers really talked about the construction of space through the photographs. And I also briefly wanted to ask Ruth about the cinematic aspects that you're looking at. So there's like references to the Hollywood star system. But you mentioned some things about the stillness of the photograph that actually kind of confuses us. So because it looks like a still from a moving image. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered if you were also thinking about that as a creation of movement, like that photography is really essential, or if it was mm-hmm. what it was at hand. And then for you, sorry, I wondered if you could explain a bit more what a clipping is. I'm not familiar with it, and it seems essential to kind of understanding the reference point. And you also seem to similarly kind of push back against the traditional reading of Spalten, where you offered this third kind of maneuver. And I wondered if you could speak more about how he had access to so much film. Was it pure wealth, or was it obsessive, or if you could kind of say more about his practice in that regard.
Yeah.
What kind of camera, or is it large format, or I'm just kind of curious to imagine how he went about all of these photographs. How cumbersome was it?
Thanks so much for your question, Eliza. I'm going to try and keep this brief and time myself because I can talk about Kiwi forever and I need to calm down. Mm-hmm. But I really like you said, was it just what's at hand? I think that's a very insightful point because I do get the sense in the collection that he is using like whatever is at hand to kind of construct a celebrity, but also remake the space for herself. You mentioned the star system, so there is actually District 6 star. Well, I'm calling it the District 6 star system. So as I'm sure you know, the girls had this tradition. They adopted the names after women celebrities, often from Hollywood, sometimes French actresses. So QB's stage name, and it was when they performed on stage. But in QB's collection, they're all referred to as these names, and they use it in their everyday life as well. So QB, when she started, was Doris Day. And then that was in use by an older queen, so she changed to Capucine after the French model and actress. And in the first photograph, I'm sure you saw, it said Miss Capucine and Miss Andrews. That's Julie Andrews in her first movie, Girls Will Be Boys, Boys Will Be Girls. And in particular, with regards to the paparazzi photos I was talking about, so A Star is Born, the Judy Garland one, is like a very important film to keep in, and her recollections kind of comes to stand for this, like, possibility of like romance and it's like anything's possible. And I've been thinking about those paparazzi shots in relation to A Star is Born and the idea of like constructing a celebrity that is authentic.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess the ways I'm thinking about the cinematic again is kind of all the ways I can. I'm trying to like work closely with the photographs and see what comes up. But I think there is in the interviews with QP, for example, Gala has audio interviews and filmed interviews. And I've been thinking about the accounts she gives in each, and the fact that in the filmed interviews, generally it's kind of a much more curated version of District 6 that she talks about, whereas in the audio recording, like you saw, she's like a lot more open and says like all kinds of interesting things. So that's been making me think about the camera itself as a kind of technology of curation. I'm a bit scared of incurring the wrath of like film scholars and photography scholars by trying to talk about the ways that we might think of the camera as similar in both respects. But I'm also trying to remain attentive to the way that, of course, photography and film are different, and the way she uses photography as a medium of performance is specific to photography, and the way she uses film as a medium of performance, I think, is specific to film. If that kind of starts answering your question, but I'd be very grateful for any thoughts you have as well. Thank you.
So in terms of Skolten, he was mostly working with a medium format camera, but I think it really came down to incredible wealth. So he had quite a lot of money, and actually lost quite a lot of money in the stock market crash in 1929. Mm. There's little in the way of written documentation on Skolten, but there are a few letters, and there's documentation of him talking to a friend about the fact that his stepmother wouldn't give him any more money. So money clearly did become an issue, by the late 1920s for him. But yeah, he definitely, to me, I kind of... I've developed quite a soft spot for him as a person. I think it would be very easy, particularly coming from a Palestinian background, to feel irritated with some of the Orientalist narratives. But actually, I think there's a sort of a sensitivity there and a sort of a... He's clearly somebody who's kind of going on a... I hesitate to call it a pilgrimage. I'm sure that there is a religious aspect for him, but I think it's sort of also a sense of self-discovery and trying to work a few things out. There are references in some of the works written about Dahan that Skolten was charged with something in 1920-ish, which part of his trip to Palestine could have been something redemptive in terms of trying to, number one, avoid jail sentence, but yeah. Number two, also go elsewhere. But the clippings are also a really interesting thing, and the man is absolutely meticulous in everything he does. He's an amateur photographer, he's an amateur ethnographer. We don't know exactly what he studied. We know that he came to Berlin before the war and studied something in the realm of music, literature, and art. We don't know exactly when he took up photography, but the earliest ones seem to be roughly around about World War I. But this sort of process of clippings, also demonstrates quite a lot of wealth. So he was clearly collecting photographic books about Palestine, biblical tracts, some of which are actually incredibly valuable. So he has, for instance, images that are clipped from an 1854 book by August Saltzman, who was a French... Yeah. So, and you sort of see these things kind of cut up and... I kind of sit there and I'm like, wow, that I don't know how much that book cost at the time, but it was, it was a very pricey sort of publication. But the sort of clippings are a way, I think, for him of making sense. When they're often photographs or images that have been pasted to a piece of paper, a piece of cardboard, and on the back he'll put a biblical reference. So, I also think it's kind of almost like a set of working notes towards this idea of an illustrated Bible. That publication never happened, but he did produce a two-volume set, which were predominantly photos of Jaffa. So they were published first of all in French, then in German, then in English, and then only one of the two volumes in his native Dutch, which is quite interesting. But the way the books are constructed is that they're predominantly photographic, and he'll use a mixture of biblical quotes, Quranic quotes, and Talmudic quotes alongside historical quotes. So he's sort of trying to visually piece together, his perceptions of Jaffa, I suppose. Yeah.
Okay, I have questions.
I would like to ask Ruth, maybe you mentioned, but who were the photographers of Kipi? And then I write to notice that the first photographs were on Polaroid.
It seems they're not. I initially thought that they were Polaroids and went off and wrote loads of stuff about how they were Polaroids and then realised they weren't. But the in terms of the photograph, is there's, like as I was saying, it's a huge range of photographic practices. You see the street scene photography. The initial series I showed, I think, is taken by herself, by Kipi and the girls. Like there's certain marks, I think, in the more kind of the photographs taken by the kind of the Kipi and the girls, where there's shadows cast and some things are off-centered. But then there's her friend's husband was a professional photographer, so she'd go hang out with them all the time and get him to photograph her constantly in these like these beautiful black and white shots. There's a few in photo booths. There's a couple of by press photographers, like everyone. And it's sad actually that we can't. I know Gala's sad as well that we can't figure out exactly who the photographers are for each image. But I think are good guesses for most of them, and also photographs that were given to her by completely different people.
I think Kipi staged for.
Sorry.
She staged for herself these photos.
Yeah, exactly.
And not left it for the photographer.
Yeah.
I have a question for Sadek. You mentioned he was queer. Is this something you infer from his work, or you have like archival material that suggests his queerness?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question, and I don't really have an answer for it. As I said, the entire collection is uncatalogued, so that the university has been very kindly in allowing me to sort of dig through something that's a complete mess. One of my colleagues had a brief look at it a few months before I had arrived, and was the one that actually told me about the collection and. She saw a diary which was somewhere in one of the boxes, which we now can't locate, rather irritatingly. But but it did have details of a French boyfriend. So we know that he was definitely. I think there's a sort of a problem in using these sort of terms in a time when they weren't current. Mm-hmm. He essentially did things with other men. And we also know from some of the writing on Dahan that he was hanging around in Amsterdam Central picking up guys, but also the...
So people who wrote about Dahan also wrote about Stockholm?
Yeah. And apparently, I think that photo, as I said in that last slide, was Adelaide, Dahan's boyfriend. But I'm not sure, but we definitely know that in Jerusalem, Spolkin photographed Aweda and Dahan together. So there's also sort of references to that. And he was also, at some stage, he's known to have frequented a particular gay brothel in De Pijp, which is an Amsterdam suburb. So, yeah.
I don't know, I have a question, and the audience?
Well, that gives the chair of the panel the chance to ask a question. I'm working with book photography myself, and what I find, work as a historian, what I find really interesting is how certain gestures or ways of styling and ways of expressing are cutting through time. I mean, we look at pictures from the 1920s, here in Berlin, like taking it this Eldorado Club, and then we look at pictures from the 1980s from these lesbian groups, and there are so many similarities. And I was wondering if you had, how this maybe happens in your photographies as well, your photographies or the photographies you are working with.
I would say that. When I'm looking through the knowing part of the collection of Mr. Brooks, I would say there is also a kind of archive of gestures he has as a toolbox, and he can use these gestures when he wants to use them. And when he makes photographs of himself, so we saw it's a little serious, and his head being gestures, and his head being icons he tried to reenact in a way also. So these had been some examples of the toolbox, which could be named in a quite special way, kind of GLBTIQ heritage gesture toolbox. And it always depends how deep or how good is the he can get into that toolbox, how much he knows or people know or persons who know about the content of this toolbox. And then they use it, I would say.
I love that archival gestures as a toolbox. I've been thinking a lot about gesture as well. And TPME, she's a trained ballet dancer, and lots of her images are very balletic gesture. But there's also, for example, I mean, something I thought about when you were when you asked the question is, so like there's one photograph of Soupy at a club night at the Ambassador Club, at a party, and in the photo she's clearly voguing, and it's in the 1960s. And I'm like, I don't know what to do with it. I mean, to me it looks like she's voguing. She's doing something that looks like voguing, and this is the 1960s in Cape Town. There are also District 6 is right by the port, and all the like sailors would, everyone talks about they'd get off the ship and just like head straight to District 6, and there's stories about the girls being out with sailors of like all different nationalities, and say the ship captain having to like call around the different clubs that morning being like, where have you girls taken my boys? But yeah, so there are certain gestures that I think it's cut through time so clearly that it actually takes me a while to figure out how to read them.
This series of the three photographs is pure documentary, if it exists at all. My other works are also called subjective documentary, which is about the photographer and not the topics, more about the photographer and not the topics. I don't know, my times go on and the photos are changing, the surroundings changing. To tell the truth, I haven't been thinking about this.
And maybe academics can do the work in the future for you. We're going to look at the photographs and find the gesture.
Oh,
if you want to. Only if you want to.
Fine. But
I would say, I even would say, there can be single gestures on single photographies and they have a meaning. And when they are used by the people who have been photographed, they maybe have been used in full meaning.
Yeah.
So this is another content of a photography.
I mean, I think you know, particularly with Skelton, this sort of reference, all of these sort of classical references are a really sort of important one. You know, in terms of the way he frames his photographs, and you know, when you start to look at the images on maps, you do start to see a replication of this sort of classical statue. So I think there's this sort of referencing of what came before. But I think also, if we kind of think a little bit about that statue and people like, you know, Michelangelo's David, you know, it's almost a cliche these days, but, you know, if we think about Michelangelo, he's kind of doing a similar thing. You know, we've got somebody who is, you know, also queer, who is kind of trying to synthesize this kind of Greco-Roman classical past with some sort of Christian narrative. So I think there's sort of recurring art historical themes which kind of dive through the centuries, in terms of looking at some of that, those sorts of gestures.
I like the idea of gesture, then, thinking about that. This is why I've been thinking about it a lot as well, because gesture is like you gesture to someone, right? So there's like a recipient of the gesture. So yeah, I like the idea of gesture. So that's
all I can't find my answer, but it is not in connection with LGBT things. I have an individual exhibition this year, February, made of 35 pictures of my previous workplace, which is a huge concrete building, and the name is Research Center, and some institutes of Hungarian Academy of Sciences are settled in this building, which looks like the buildings in the 70s, and the title of the exhibition was the Research Center, the Memories of the 20th Century. So my intention was to reflect this era we can see this era of the 70s and 80s nowadays when we look at the building.
Yeah. So, well, I have to close the discussion now. It is a short question that can be answered
shortly.
It's just
a very short comment. If any of you are interested in QP, we have copies of the catalogue.
Oh, sorry, I didn't do my job. Sorry. Please go look at the catalogues and buy one. They're amazing.
Okay, but we can't have up in the bookstore.
At the gala.
They have a stall upstairs.
I'm going to come by. And I know you all want to leave, but I have two short announcements from the conference organizers. I informed you totally wrong. The true photo shoot takes it takes place at the large steps above the pond, so I was right with that. You should make your way to the place at 6:15. The photo will be taken 6:30, so 18:30. And if you don't want to keep your conference program and these gorgeous lanyards, you should bring them back, but you probably don't want to keep them. But in case if you want to throw them away, don't throw them away, leave them at the information desk. I want to thank all of you for being here and this amazing